welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, March 9th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. We'll take a brief look at weather, and it's been a bit of a roller coaster. Today, for instance, it is going to be mostly sunny and windy with winds from the northwest of 20 to 30 miles an hour. In Cedar Rapids, the high is going to be 44 and the low is 23. Tomorrow, not quite as windy, still a little breezy, 5 to 15 miles an hour, wind from the northwest, sunny though, and the high is going to be 52, so we're heading in a bit of a warmer direction. And then on Monday, mostly sunny, winds 15 to 25 with a high of 66 and a low of 42. Now, our normal highs and lows for this time of year are 43 for the high and 24 for the low. We had a record high in 1977 of 66 degrees and in 2003 a record low of 3 degrees. Tonight, our sunset will be at 7:07 p.m., and a little later sunrise tomorrow. I bet you can guess why. Tomorrow's sunrise will be at 7:26 a.m. And not surprisingly, the top weather story today is about daylight savings time, and it's from meteorologist Eric Dean. Daylight savings time begins this weekend. It's that time of year, the time when our clocks go ahead 1 hour as daylight savings time begins. Did you know that the U.S. is not the only country to observe daylight saving time? Heck, we aren't even the first country to observe it. That title goes to Germany. The reason why Germany started observing it is because the Germans believed moving the clocks ahead an hour saved money by limiting use of artificial lighting. The U.S. started adopting it in 1918 after several European countries followed suit. Arizona and Hawaii are the only two states that do not observe daylight saving time. So whether you are in favor of it or not, just remember tonight to turn your clocks ahead, spring ahead, and fall back. The Gazette's lead story is from Marissa Payne, titled Marion Council Eyes Uptown Parking, OK's Bell Tower Lofts. Dateline Marion. Despite worries that the transformation of the historic Marion Methodist Church into Bell Tower Lofts apartments could worsen uptown parking, the Marion City Council unanimously approved the site plan for the project this week, with assurance sufficient parking exists in the high-traffic area of the city. The Council's 6-0 approval of the site plan Thursday, with Mayor Nick Abu Asali absent, moves the $10 million to $11 million project one step closer to beginning. The historic building, which was saved from demolition through a last-minute deal in 2022, will be transformed into 55 rental units and common spaces at the southeast corner of 8th Avenue and 12th Street in Marion. Amenities will include a workout room, mail room, leasing office, and social spaces. Crews are expected to break ground later this month or in April. The final development agreement will come to the council in April or May. The project is anticipated to wrap up in 18 months. At a Tuesday work session, some council members expressed concern about sufficient parking in Uptown, an area the city is studying to assess parking needs. That study is anticipated to come to the council this spring. Dave Hockett, Marion's principal planner, said it will factor in new developments such as the Broad and Main apartments and the anticipated redevelopment of the old Marion Public Library site at 1095 6th Avenue. Hockett said Bell Tower Lofts will have 22 parking spots on the property and another 13 leased from Farmer State Bank for 3 years with a potential 5-year extension option. Within 300 feet, there are 34 public parking lot spaces and 72 on-street parking spaces, including 20 time-limited stalls which allow overnight parking. That's approximately 141 spots total. Hockett said, with the downtown parking environment, there's always going to be that car shuffle. If you get home late, park a little farther away. In the morning, you reshuffle your cars. It's a pretty standard practice in uptown living environments, end quote. Parking is concentrated in popular areas such as 7th Avenue, where restaurants and other businesses are located. But Hockett said parking still should be available on surrounding blocks. Councilmember Grant Harper said the parking study will provide a framework for how the city thinks about parking impacts on future projects, but, quote, this project in and of itself doesn't elevate a tripwire for us. We've got a very historic structure uptown, and we've got to find a way to save it, and this project does that, end quote. Councilmember Gage Miskimen said the city cares about the perceived parking problem because residents express concerns, but ultimately resident behavior can't be predicted. Some may forego dedicated parking spots in favor of closer public parking, for instance, saying a lot of communities in Iowa especially would wish that they're in the place that we're in to worry about parking in their uptown and downtown areas, end quote. The council last fall signed a development agreement and earmarked $2.5 million in federal community development block grant disaster recovery funds for the project. The federal government awarded $57.6 million to the state of Iowa, mostly to projects in Linn County, to aid in recovery from the 2020 derecho. The church, built in 1896, most recently housed the Pentecostals of Greater Cedar Rapids. In 2022, it was named as one of the most endangered properties in the state by Preservation Iowa. It was sold to Conlon Construction for just under $100,000 to be saved and redeveloped. Under the terms associated with using the disaster recovery funds, at least 51% of the units, of 29 rental units, or 15 units, must be leased to people or households at or below 80% of the area median family income. That's for the portion of the project covered by CDBG funds. The developer also received $650,000 in 2022 in brownfield redevelopment tax credits from the Iowa Economic Development Authority toward the project. Kyle Martin, president of Martin Gardner Architecture, recently told the Gazette, "The original portion of the church is planned to be refurbished, brought back to the original character as much as possible. The 1990s addition and the original mid-century classroom addition are going to be modernized." Hockett said much of the original brick would be preserved, and they really are trying to use as much as they can of the original buildings, end quote. Some of the building's stained glass windows will be refurbished in place with new protective storm coverings and with more light filtering inside. Some of the windows will be removed, crated, taken off-site, and rebuilt. Others might be partially removed, restored, and put back in a new unit while the rest of the window could be restored in place. Our second story on the Gazette's front page is by Vanessa Miller, titled Community Colleges Would Work Together to Divvy Up Aid. In collaboration with Iowa's 15 community colleges, lawmakers are moving through a measure to change, for the first time in 20 years, the way state general aid is distributed across the campuses. The new distribution model, which has been under discussion for years, would be collaborative and would prioritize providing the highest quality educational opportunities and services to the greatest number of students. The proposal says current law provides that adjustments to community college state general aid allocations are required to be made based on outcomes of audits of student enrollment. The bill strikes this provision. Should Senate File 2405 pass, starting in July 2025, community college presidents and chancellors would convene annually to draft before October 31st a formula for the coming budget year. In doing so, they would consider enrollment and combined support for each community college, along with any other factors deemed relevant. At least 10 of the 15 community college heads must agree and then submit the formula to the Iowa Department of Education. If they can't agree, the department would step in and come up with a distribution model for the year. No distribution formula proposed by either the president or the department could allocate funding to a community college below its general state aid the previous year unless lawmakers cut the total base funding appropriation. Emily Shields, executive director for the nonprofit advocacy association Community Colleges for Iowa, said, "This will be a big improvement. All the presidents are on board. We've had unanimous support for this at every turn," end quote. A Senate committee passed the measure Thursday, meaning the bill now is eligible for debate by the full Senate, and it isn't subject to an upcoming legislative deadline meant to winnow the bills lawmakers will consider this session. The state's total community college general appropriation for the current budget year is $228.9 million, a 3.2% increase over fiscal 2023's $227.7 million, which was up 3% over 2022. In addition to general aid, the state provides tens of millions to community colleges for workforce training programs, along with corrections education and various forms of concurrent enrollment funding involving high schoolers taking college courses. Iowa's existing community college aid distribution formula is complex, using inflation as a determining factor, along with base funding, three-year rolling averages of full-time equivalent enrollment, and marginal cost adjustments. If the state's general aid increases 3% or more, it would trigger an extraordinary growth adjustment that would change the distribution formula. Bringing in the biggest chunk of state general aid under the current funding model are the state's biggest community colleges, Des Moines Area Community College, followed by Kirkwood in Cedar Rapids. But Shields said, given enrollment growth, some smaller colleges are getting more than the average per student, while others are getting below the average, like DMAC. The goal with the new funding model, she said, is to make sure the funds will be distributed as fairly and equitably as possible. Kirkwood President Christy Fisher told the Gazette by email this funding formula review was a collaborative effort, saying the funding formula has been untouched for nearly 20 years, and changes in enrollment patterns really drove the review to ensure it was distributing state general aid equitably, end quote. Among other bills involving Iowa's community colleges is the sweeping Higher Education Reform Act of 2024, focusing on the Board of Regents and its three public universities, but also would impose a new work-study program for community colleges, among other requirements. The work-study mandate would require community colleges by fall of 2025 to establish a program allowing students to complete an associate degree while working part-time for an employer who agrees to pay all tuition and fee costs and also a wage of at least the state minimum. Community Colleges for Iowa reports most of its members already have employer partnerships involving tuition and fee coverage, meaning the bill mandate wouldn't change much. Fisher told the Gazette, Kirkwood already has employers who choose to pay employee tuition, so it's not a new concept for community colleges, and a program could likely not change any of our relationships with business and industry. Our goal would simply be to ensure a new program doesn't require more work on the part of students, employers, or the college. A mandate in the bill restricting any faculty senate committee or subcommittee from having governance authority wouldn't change the community college's current practices, as those boards all are advisory. As to language in the proposed bill requiring community colleges to adopt policies that follow state law, regardless of rules from accrediting agencies, Fisher said, "It is our obligation to follow state law, and we always do this. It is my hope that we never find ourselves in a position that a state law would conflict with accreditation, because our accreditation is what makes our students eligible for financial aid and successful transfers." Vanessa Miller has also contributed the last story on the Gazette's front page under the title Thriving Yet Struggling, Campus Researchers Probe Mental Health. Dateline Iowa City. Back in September, student leaders from Iowa's public universities implored the Board of Regents to provide more mental health resources, writing in a letter that, quote, students on our campuses are in significant need of increased accessibility and options for mental health and well-being, end quote. But mental health on campus isn't just a concern among students. Faculty and staff across Iowa and the nation are facing heightened mental health needs too, both personally and professionally, in their role responding to the student distress they see in their classrooms. Iowa University of Iowa Clinical Professor of Counseling Psychology Barry Schreier said the literature out there says students have turned in increasing number to the people they know, which often is the staff and faculty around them. Mr. Schreier directs higher education programming for the Scanlon Center for School Mental Health at the UI. The question of whether faculty and staff feel confident and competent to help those students who come to them with mental health needs and intervene if necessary is one that UI researchers asked recently of faculty and staff at 7 Iowa community colleges. Staff and faculty said, "No, not as much as I think I would like to." The community college survey administered last year was phase one of a larger State of Iowa Higher Education Staff and Faculty Mental Health and Well-Being Study the Scanlon Center is running across Iowa's community colleges, Regent universities, and private higher education institutions. Schreier said, "Given the success we had with that phase, we are now engaging in phase two. We're now soliciting additional community colleges, private schools in the state of Iowa, and then we're going to start eventually sampling the Regent universities. Phase two, starting in April, will pose the same questions put to several thousand community college faculty and staff a year ago, nearly 1,200 of whom responded for a 30% response rate. Schreier said that is an astronomical response rate for survey research norms, crediting a five-step process they used in part for the strong response. We made first contact with the colleges the first week of April 2023, and then four successive times across a period of 5 weeks, reminders and follow-ups. In addition to asking faculty and staff how they feel about responding to student distress, researchers asked whether they actually do. Schreier said a large number of our samples said, "Yes, I'm already responding to students, even though I'm not sure I know exactly what I'm doing," end quote. The research comes as a growing body of national data indicates students, staff, and faculty across higher education are experiencing mental health problems, work-related burnout, and long-term pandemic fallout. A UI personal health assessment administered to faculty and staff in 2022 found 55% of respondents were thriving on a well-being index, 43% were struggling, and 1% identified as suffering. Additionally, a 2021 UI Live Well survey of faculty and staff found 22% reported health risks from unmanaged stress, 25% had difficulty concentrating due to health concerns, 29% had difficulty focusing due to financial stress, and 56% had trouble concentrating due to too much work and too little time to do it. Thus, in addition to surveying Iowa faculty and staff on their preparedness to help students, researchers are asking about their own mental health and what institutional supports exist to help them. Schreier said of the community college results from phase one, 20-30% of faculty and staff are responding with symptoms of burnout, and they are endorsing symptoms of anxiety and endorsing symptoms of depression, end quote. But the study also asked respondents questions of whether they're flourishing, and a large majority said they were. About 88% of faculty and staff said they are competent and capable of activities important to them. About 87% said they are a good person and live a good life. And 76-79% said they actively contribute to the happiness and well-being of others. Schreier said, "What we discovered that's really important for campuses is to not just tell staff and faculty they are burned out and anxious and depressed, but to also tell them they are flourishing. That's the whole picture," he said. "Mental health on campus is struggle and flourishing." The same can be true for students, according to Schreier, who said a majority of faculty and staff from the study's first phase reported having one-on-one conversations with students about their mental health and referring them to resources, even though a quarter said they thought someone else is better suited to do this. The research found a majority of respondents wanted more training, as only a quarter had received any. When asked about other resources faculty and staff want in addressing student needs, the survey responses said 64% wanted a list of resources, 57% said a list of things to consider, and 41% said suicide prevention training. Schreier said, "Based on each campus's data, we are then making recommendations to the campus. Here are the recommendations via your faculty and staff and how they responded at what they would like to see the campus do in response to this." In the Iowa Today section, the first story is a staff report titled, "Repair Work Beginning on Closed Bridge at Lansing." A contractor has been doing prep work, so repairs on the historic Black Hawk Bridge over the Mississippi River at Lansing can begin, nearly 2 weeks after the crossing was ordered closed for safety reasons. The Iowa Department of Transportation said Friday that as part of the repair work, sections of the bridge decking will be removed, closing the bridge to pedestrians as well as vehicles. The repairs would take about 2 months. The bridge connecting Allamaquia County in Iowa with Crawford County in Wisconsin was ordered closed on February 25th after the structure moved. Engineers determined that two piers had shifted. The Iowa DOT said Friday part of its work would be to test other piers and to ensure that the bridge does not shift again. On February 29th, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a disaster proclamation allowing the state to tap into a federal emergency road repair fund. The estimated cost of the repairs has not been announced. Just 50 feet to the north of the Black Hawk Bridge, which opened in 1931, construction of a new $140 million bridge to replace it began last fall. But the new connector is not expected to be complete until the end of 2026. While the bridge remains closed, drivers have to travel for miles to find another crossing over the Mississippi. The Iowa DOT estimates about 2,220 crossings a day at the bridge. Other options for crossing the river are either to the south using Highway 18 between Marquette and Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, or to the north, crossing the river on Highway 14 between La Crescent, Minnesota, and La Crosse, Wisconsin. The Iowa DOT said earlier it was exploring alternatives for drivers. Some suggested a ferry over the river, but it has provided no updates. From Emily Anderson, a brief article, One Dead in Head-On Crash, Dateline Earlville. One person died Thursday after a head-on collision between a semi-truck and a pickup in Delaware County, according to a crash report from the Iowa State Patrol. The crash happened on 210th Street east of Earlville at 3:25 p.m. The driver of the pickup truck, Terry Meyer, was driving east and crossed the center of the road for an unknown reason. He crashed into the semi, driven by Tom Burcham Jr., which was heading west, the report states. Meyer, age 59, of Dyersville, was pronounced dead at the scene. Burcham, 50, of Earlville, was taken to the Regional Medical Center in Manchester, then to University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics to be treated for his injuries. The crash remains under investigation. Emily Anderson also contributes this article, Man Injured in Small Explosion in Linn County, Dateline Fairfax. A Palo man was injured in a small explosion northwest of Fairfax on Friday morning, according to a news release from Linn County Sheriff's Office. Carson Mosier, age 46, was using his work trailer stored at 4303 Morgan Bridge Road when he started a generator that backfired and caused nearby flammables to ignite, creating a small explosion. Mosier, who was injured, went to the house on the property to ask for assistance, and the residents called 911 at about 7 a.m. Emergency responders treated Mosier on the scene, and then he was taken by ambulance to UI Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, listed in critical but stable condition, the release stated. The fire in the trailer was extinguished by the Fairfax Fire Department. No other structures were damaged, according to the sheriff's news release. And we have another brief story here from Trish Mahaffey, woman sentenced to 40 years for child pornography. Dateline Cedar Rapids, a federal judge sentenced a Cedar Rapids woman to 40 years in prison for producing child pornography videos and distributing them online to others. Abigail Elizabeth Lambert, age 32, pleaded last October to one count of distribution of child pornography and one count of sexual exploitation of children. During the guilty plea, she admitted that she used, persuaded, induced, or enticed at least one minor to engage in sexually explicit conduct for the purpose of producing one or more videos. She also admitted to knowingly distributing the child pornography over the internet. In June 2023, according to court documents, Lambert exchanged messages with an undercover officer posing as someone looking for child pornography over a fetish website. Lambert told the officer she committed sexual acts with two minors and that she had videos of the acts. Lambert then sent the undercover officer some of the videos she had previously described, according to prosecutors. U.S. District Judge C.J. Williams also sentenced Lambert to 5 years of supervised release following her prison term. The case was prosecuted by Assistant U.S. Attorney Dan Chatham and investigated by the FBI and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. On today's Insight page, the Gazette's editorial is titled, "Don't Dictate History Curriculum." Last week, Republicans who control the Iowa House pushed through a bill that would require a detailed and highly prescriptive civics and history curriculum for Iowa's public schools. Partisan politicians have no business writing school curriculum. We have education professionals setting curriculum standards, and they don't need to be managed by politicians seeking to score political points. The 16-page bill dictates what civics and history lessons must be taught from elementary school through high school. Although we have no problem with teaching kids about the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Emancipation Proclamation, there are red flags all over this bill. Conservatives, who declared public school students are victims of liberal indoctrination, are simply seeking to introduce another form of indoctrination, one that teaches the United States' exceptional and praiseworthy history. It's language that smacks of propaganda rather than real history. The bill also directs teaching Iowa kids that the concept that United States history shall be viewed as factual, not as constructed, shall be viewed as knowable, teachable, and testable, and shall be defined as the creation of a new nation based largely on the universal principle stated in the Declaration of Independence. In other words, there is one true version of history to be learned. Any historian worth their credentials will disagree. The factual brand of history being pushed in the bill is its supporters' view of history, soaked in the politics of today. What's missing also is telling. Among the famous people with civic virtues students must learn are just two women, Abigail Adams and Susan B. Anthony. Slavery is mentioned, but not the failures of Reconstruction that led to Jim Crow laws and institutionalized discrimination that burdens America to this day. The Vietnam War and Watergate also are left out, as are the violent actions that drove Native Americans from their lands. The bill also bans the concept of action civics, which seeks to help students use their knowledge of government and politics by taking an active role in issues they care about. The bill's backers apparently don't like to see kids marching for LGBTQ rights or for laws addressing school shootings. On top of that, large portions of this bill have clearly been written by conservative think tanks, not Iowans. Iowa once took pride in its public schools. Now we allow outsiders with political axes to grind to alter how we educate our kids. We urge the Senate to toss aside this misguided bill and seek ways to provide teachers the resources they need to teach real civics and history. The freedom to teach the truth is one thing that makes America exceptional. There also is a guest column here titled "Bill Will Hurt Iowa Credit Unions." It's contributed by Chad Kappel, K-A-E-P-P-E-L, who is president and CEO of Cedar Falls Community Credit Union. Mr. Kappel says, "There is a decade-long effort in Washington that would change how credit cards fundamentally work. Senators Roger Marshall, Republican of Kansas, and Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, have introduced the Credit Card Competition Act. Despite the name, the proposal is anything but competitive and would pose a significant threat to American consumers' financial security and will hurt Iowa's credit unions and small banks." Marshall and Durbin have been creative in trying to pass their legislation. Last year, they made a big push to pass it as an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, despite the fact that it has absolutely nothing to do with national security. Since that failed, the bill's sponsors are pushing for a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee, but it does not have jurisdiction over banking matters and the financial services industry. At the heart of the matter is the complicated process known as interchange, the behind-the-scenes mechanism that takes place when your credit card is used to buy something. The Marshall-Durbin bill would reshape this process, allowing large corporate retailers like Target, Walmart, and Amazon to choose which payment network processes the transaction. It would have some serious consequences. Giant corporate stores would have the freedom to pick cheaper and less secure payment networks rather than the network that the cardholder chose when they decided which credit card to apply for. Consumers would be exposed to a heightened risk of fraudulent activity. In the unfortunate event of unauthorized charges, it would be the financial institutions, such as your local credit union, left on the hook for the damages. Supporters of Marshall-Durbin claim that mega companies such as Target and Walmart will pass the savings back to the consumer. Unfortunately, we know definitively that this is not true because this proposal has been tried with your debit card and prices went up as a result, not down. This previous change to your debit card, known as the Durbin Amendment, increased fraud by 59% since it was passed, according to a study by the Federal Reserve Board. Credit unions stand apart from large financial institutions because they are deeply committed to the communities they serve, especially here in Iowa. The Marshall-Durbin bill, however, poses a direct threat to these community-focused financial institutions. Even with an attempted exemption, the credit card market writ large will be impacted, meaning that the money collected by local credit unions to support programs and provide benefits for their members would be lost. Iowa is lucky to have a strong congressional delegation that understands our state's values and will protect the best interests of Iowans. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst must continue to stand up for those values and focused on issues that really matter to Iowans right now, such as the crisis at the southern border, not a corporate handout to big box stores. We urge our senators to stand up for small financial institutions, secure networks, and the safety of our communities. Obviously, that is an advocacy article written by Chad Kappel, who is president and CEO of Cedar Falls Community Credit Union. As a reminder, you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, March 9th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. There are five longer obituaries today, but we'll just let you know that there are also two of the shorter notices, and those are for Jerry Laverne Ingles, I-N-G-L-E-S, age 77, of Greeley, who died Thursday, March 7th. Arrangements are being made through Leonard Muller Funeral Home and Crematory. And in North English, Richard Mark Greenlee, age 50, died Wednesday, March 6th. The family is being assisted by Powell Funeral Home in North English. Our first longer obituary is for Carlene Puckhaber Smallwood, who was 84 years old and of Brush, Colorado, formerly of Cedar Rapids. She passed away Monday, February 19th, and per her request was cremated. She was an only child graduating from Franklin High School in Cedar Rapids in 1947 and a graduate of Young's School of Beauty. She was then a beautician in Cedar Rapids for many years and moved to Colorado in 1974. The family asks that donations in her memory be made to the Cedar Valley Humane Society, where she worked for many years. Next, our obituary is for Chad M. Smith, age 43, of Cedar Rapids, who died after a cancer battle at the Oldhorf House of Mercy, and he died on Thursday, March 7th. He had lived in Vinton and Winthrop. He graduated from East Buchanan High School and went on to work for Fisher Printing and Nordstrom's in Cedar Rapids. A visitation will be held from 3 until 6 tomorrow, March 10th, at the Reef Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Winthrop, with a graveside service at 11 a.m. at Fremont Cemetery in Winthrop. Debbie Sladek, age 66, of Iowa City, passed away Wednesday, March 6th at UI Hospital following a long illness. Her funeral mass was held today, March 9th at 10 a.m. in Hills, and there had been a visitation. She'll be buried in Oak Hill Cemetery in Coralville in lieu of flowers. Donations may be made to help with funeral expenses or given to Camp Courageous on her behalf. Next is an obituary for Gaylord Kenneth Owens of Lisbon, who died at the age of 101 on March 7th. Visitation will be tomorrow from 3 to 5, Sunday, March 10th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral Home and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon, with the funeral service Monday, March 11th at Uncommon Church, formerly First Federated Church, at 115 North Walnut Street in Lisbon. Those unable to attend are invited to watch the service via live stream. You can find that link through the tribute wall at the stuartbaxter.com website. Memorials may be directed to the family or a charity of your choice. He was a World War II veteran. He worked for Stamets Publishing for 21 years, had his own printing business for 10 years, Owens Impressions, and also was a longtime leader for Christian Service Brigade, a faith-based organization for teenage boys, the obituary says. Next, we have Lila Florence Snyder, born Lila Florence Bramer, age 96, who died March 8th. She worked for at least 20 years in a small engine factory in Maquoketa, and then 11 and a half years at Farmstead Foods in Cedar Rapids. Per her wishes, she was cremated, and her remains will be buried in her family plot in Wyoming, Iowa. Private graveside services will be held at the burial and a family celebration of life at their annual summer picnic. They invite cards of condolences to Dawson Funeral Services, P.O. Box 258, Wyoming, Iowa, 52362. Or you may, of course, leave an online condolence at DawsonFuneral.com. We have two more obituaries to share with you. First, John Dean Inskeep Jr., age 89, of Cedar Rapids, who died March 6th at St. Luke's Hospital. Services will be at Radiant Church, Cedar Rapids, with visitation tomorrow, Sunday, March 10th, from 4 to 7 p.m., and then the funeral on Monday, March 11th, at 10:30 a.m., with burial at 2 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. He was born and grew up in Centerville until he was 11, and then they moved to Virginia. Then he attended school and returned to Seymour, Iowa, for his senior year of high school, and sort of stayed in the Midwest after that, ultimately accepting a position as underwriter at Western Fraternal Life Association of Cedar Rapids, where he worked until he retired in 1999. The obituary speaks at length about his faith and how important that was to him. The family also offers a public thank you to caregivers Melissa, Tricia, Joanne, and Peggy, and the entire nursing staff at St. Luke's Fifth Floor Central, as well as his doctor, pastor, and Paul Brower, his barber for almost 50 years. They invite people who wish to do so to send memorial contributions to His Hands Free Clinic, His Hands Free Clinic, Camp Courageous, Radiant Church, or a charity of your choice. And finally, Phyllis Jean Hoge. I'm not sure I'm saying it right. It might be Hoge, H-O-G-E, age 80, of Springville, who passed away March 6th at Terrace Glen Village in Marion. The memorial service will be Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. at Springville Presbyterian Church, and then visitation following from 3 to 7. She graduated from Springville High School and had attended nursing school, where she did earn a nursing degree. We'll move to prep sports now, and my goodness, we've got state champions on our hand. Boys State Basketball Class 1A Championship. Jeff Johnson has written a story under the title Unprecedented Run, North Lynn Collects Another Championship. Dateline Des Moines. Coaches know, and Mike Hilmer knew, his North Lynn team was not a state championship contender partway through this boys' basketball season. Maybe not a contender for the state tournament, despite being top-ranked and rolling through the competition per usual. There was a game in which the coach was especially perturbed. North Lynn won it handily, but it played what he thought was a very poor second half, saying, "I quit doing scouting reports for two games." I said, if I'm not going to waste my time, I'm not going to waste my time if you guys aren't going to execute them. I don't care what the score is. We're not playing against the scoreboard. We're playing against our potential, end quote. A loss to Albernette followed. Then there was a game at the end of the regular season against Dunkerton that North Lynn won, but still wasn't doing the things Hilmer wanted it to do. And then he said, from that day on, these kids locked in and ended up winning it all. North Lynn overcame a 5-point deficit late in the third quarter to beat Marquette for the second time this season. The Lynx won the late regular season game 69-60. They got way ahead early, led by double figures at halftime, and withstood a Marquette rally. This game was expectedly well different. North Lynn led by 5 after the first quarter and by 3 at halftime, but Marquette got on an offensive roll in the third behind guard Cannon. Cannon, who had 3 3-pointers. The defenders went up 42-37 on a Spencer Rotter inside hoop late in the frame. Composure helped North Lynn come back, as did Mason Becken and Jake Van Etten. They scored 19 of their team's final 20 points, helping the Lynx forge a 44-all tie after 3 quarters. Then, eventually go ahead by 4, 55-51 with just over a minute left. And they ended up winning that game 57-56. This was the 8th straight state tournament appearance for North Lynn, its unprecedented 7th consecutive appearance in a championship game. The school is now 3-5 in those games. That is the only prep sport article in the Gazette today, but there is one article, there's a page devoted to women's wrestling, and the National Collegiate Women's Wrestling Championships were held Friday at Alliant Energy Powerhouse, and there is a story by KJ Pilcher titled North Central Duo Share NCWWC Title Dreams, and that is the National Collegiate Women's Wrestling Championships, that's that acronym. And the article reads, Dateline Cedar Rapids, different journeys with the same goal in sight. One was a blue-chip recruit that has been one of the nation's top wrestlers transferring into the program. The other wasn't as heralded coming out of high school, but has worked and ascended the ranks. Jaslyn Gallegos and Kendra Ryan provide North Central with not one, but 2 of the top 109-pound competitors in the country. Cardinals coach Joe Norton said, I think they are the best 2 girls in the country at the weight. It's a tale of 2 careers, end quote. Top-seeded Ryan and number 3 Gallegos each dominated their way through the quarterfinals at the NCWWC on Friday at Alliant Energy Powerhouse. The Cardinals advanced 11 of 12 to the semifinals. North Central qualified the maximum of 15 at 10 weight classes. The Cardinals have multiple entrants at 5 weights, 109, 130, 136, 155, and 191. Gallego said, it's pretty common on our team. I don't think anybody on our team lets it affect any of our relationships with each other. We're a pretty tight-knit family. Everyone has big goals, and we all respect each other for that. I wouldn't say it's affected anything, really. End quote. Gallegos was the 116-pound NCWWC champion last season. Ryan is a 2-time All-American, placing 5th at 109 a year ago. Ryan also had All-American teammates in her bracket in her first 2 appearances. She said, honestly, I'm used to it. I think it's good. It's good to push each other. It's good to work off each other's energy. It's helpful to improve my wrestling overall. End quote. Gallegos' move was based on the Olympic weights and compete in the U.S. Olympic team trials in April. Despite her success, she was a little light for 116. Saying, I was walking around light for 116 the last 3 years. I had a lot of people over the years tell me, you do so well at a weight that you're walking kind of light at. Imagine what you could do at a smaller weight. For the international stuff is why I decided to go down, end quote. Gallegos from Brighton, Colorado, wrestled for NCAA Division I Presbyterian SC College for 3 seasons. She was a 3-time All-American for the Blue Hose. Ryan from Fenton, Michigan, has steadily improved during her career. She received a boost from the Under-23 World Team Trials in the off-season. Ryan placed 3rd and went right back to work. The two don't regularly train together. Each has specific teammates and style they like to drill and practice with, having more than 50 teammates to choose from. Gallego said, "We occasionally work out. We do different things in practice, and sometimes we switch up partners. I think I have one or two favorite drill partners I consistently go with, but I do love going with Kendra. She's very fiery on her feet," end quote. Both blazed through opponents to reach the semifinals and secure top six All-American finishes. Gallegos posted two falls with a technical fall in between. She closed with a 25-second pin over King University's Ryan, blanked Mount Olive's Samantha Miller 10-0 in the quarterfinals, but opened the tournament with one of Cardinal's 28 bonus victories and 13 pins on day one. In the living section, Elijah Decius has provided this article titled Soul Survivor. When Erica Schwartz started attending a Holocaust survivor group over 40 years ago, she didn't quite fit in. Born in a Hungary ghetto one day before the Nazis sealed it off in 1944, she had the paperwork to prove she is one of the youngest remaining survivors alive today at age 79, but despite most of her entire family being murdered before World War II ended, it wasn't until about 9 years ago that others started taking her story seriously. As an infant, Schwartz's father helped her and her mother escape to Budapest with the right paperwork, where the two lived disguised as Christians into the early years of the Soviet Union's control. Her father, a labor camp escapee, lived on the run to avoid making his family a target. Before long, he was returned to the labor camp in Hungary and murdered too. At age 4, Erica was sent after her mother to the U.S. It wasn't until she was about 70 that she started to tell this story, saying, "I got the sense that people didn't really see me as a Holocaust survivor. I didn't remember people getting slaughtered in front of me. The fact that I'd lost my entire family didn't seem to matter. It was difficult to have that sense of loss and feel that it wasn't important enough, that everyone else who remembered it was more important," end quote. Unlike many survivors, Schwartz's story starts with her mother's memories about how parents, grandparents, siblings, and cousins were exterminated. But her mother's personal experience, never recounted aloud to her, affected her all the same. After being emotionally destroyed by the loss of her entire family, her mother, who had post-traumatic stress disorder, led a nomadic lifestyle. By the time she was an adolescent, Schwartz had attended 9 elementary schools. Despite that, her most vivid memory of Hungary was playing with pebbles around a train station as her mother left the country, she inherited all the same effects of trauma as an adult: low self-esteem, bitterness, and a struggle to find meaning in life that lasted until she was middle-aged. After growing up with a mother who refused to talk about her personal experiences, Schwartz started to shun her family history too. For about a third of her life, she refused to think, talk, or read about what had happened as she battled depression, saying, "I needed to reprogram what was in my head." The need to speak out wasn't realized until she was called at a religious ceremony in her former California home. In a room of about 350 people, survivors of the Holocaust were asked to stand and be honored. She resisted the urge until her husband jabbed her. After heeding his call, she was the only one in the room standing. "That's when it hit me, that being one of the youngest Holocaust survivors, I had an obligation. I needed to bear witness to what had happened to my family." The next day, she called the Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles, where she learned how to document the story of her mother and her own story. Now, many of her lectures are geared toward students who have similarities. They have no first-hand memories of the Holocaust, and they're growing up in an era where anti-Semitism is again on public display. Impacted by a history beyond her control, her story has touched students whose lives also have been a byproduct of their parents' trauma. With a message of hope, Erica tells stories of finding joy again. Today, she tells others how she lives a life happier than she's ever been against the backdrop of tragedies hard-earned through years of research that would alter her family forever, saying, "I was walking around with my head in a black cloud until my mid-40s. I had an epiphany that I didn't have to spend the rest of my life in that headspace," end quote. In addition to the story of those who impacted her, she tells the story of others who can't speak, even ones she's never met. In 2017, for example, she placed a headstone on her youngest aunt's grave in Hungary, where for 73 years she had been buried anonymously. With anti-Semitism on the rise and a sharp increase in violence against Jews domestically and abroad, her message plays a role for the next generation. Schwartz said, "The most astonishing part is what's happening in this country and how brazenly open it is." End quote. She urges students today to study not just the Holocaust, but the events that led up to it and the parallels they have today for Jews and other marginalized groups through proliferating propaganda that have pitted groups against each other from all sides, saying, "You'll see it happening in this country now. I'm not just talking about Jews." End quote. If you would like to hear more about her story and others, you can hear her at two appearances that are coming up Monday, April 1st at 7 p.m. at Coe College's Sinclair Auditorium in Cedar Rapids, and then Tuesday, April 2nd at 1:30 p.m. in Kirkwood Community College's Ballantine Auditorium in Cedar Rapids. She will be speaking there. Is no cost, no tickets required. The Tuesday event will also be available via live stream at kirkwood.edu/VOD/12583. I know that's a lot to take in. My guess is that if you were to perhaps call Kirkwood, you would be able to get that additional information so that you could attend via live stream. We started our time together with a weather story, and so it seems fitting that we can end it with one as well. This one is a reprint from the Associated Press, but perhaps you've been asking the same question. Much of U.S. asks, where did winter go? And it reads, across much of America, and especially in the normally chilly north, the country went through the winter months, well, without winter. In parka strongholds, Burlington, Vermont, and Portland, Maine, the thermometer never plunged below zero. The state of Minnesota called the last 3 months the lost winter, warmer than its infamous year without a winter in 1877 and 78. Michigan, where mosquitoes were biting in February, offered disaster loans to businesses hit by a lack of snow. The Great Lakes set records for low winter ice, with Erie and Ontario essentially ice-free. For a wide swath of the country, from Colorado to New Jersey and Texas to the Carolinas, spring leaves are arriving 3 to 4 weeks earlier than the 1991 to 2020 average, according to the National Phenology Network, which tracks the timing of plants, insects, and other natural signs of the seasons. Yale Climate Connections meteorologist Jeff Masters, who founded the private firm Weather Underground, said long-term warming combined with El Nino conspired to make winter not show up in the U.S. this year. Masters says he was bitten by a mosquito in Michigan, which he called crazy. On Friday, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration confirmed that winter of 2023 and 24 was the warmest in nearly 130 years of record keeping for the United States. The lower 48 states averaged 37.6 degrees, which is 5.4 degrees above average. This is just the latest in a drumbeat of broken temperature records, national and global, that scientists say is mostly from human-caused climate change from the burning of coal, oil, and gas. And it was the warmest U.S. winter by a wide margin. The past 3 months were 0.82 degrees warmer than the previous record set 8 years ago, which Karen Gleason, chief of monitoring at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, says, quote, is a pretty good leap above the previous record, end quote. Last month was only the third warmest February on record, but Iowa blew past its warmest February by 2 degrees, while parts of Minnesota were 20 degrees warmer than average for all of February, Gleason said. On February 11th, Great Lakes ice cover hit a February record low of 2.7%. A strong ridge of high pressure kept the eastern U.S. warm and dry, while California kept getting hit with atmospheric rivers. The European Climate Agency Copernicus earlier this week said it was the warmest winter globally, mostly due to climate change, with an added boost from a natural El Niño, which alters weather worldwide and provides extra heat. In the past 45 years, winter has warmed faster in the U.S. than worldwide, with the lower 48 states' winters now averaging 2.2 degrees warmer than in 1980, according to an analysis of NOAA data by the Associated Press. That's probably because land warms faster than ocean, which much of the U.S. as land and most of the globe as ocean, Gleason said. While it still is getting warmer in the U.S. since 2000, the rate of extra warming has slowed a bit, NOAA data shows. Winter weather expert Judah Cohen of Atmospheric Environmental Research blames Arctic amplification, which is how climate change has made the Arctic warm 3 to 4 times more than the rest of the globe and seems to shift weather patterns further south. As the Arctic warms faster, the jet stream, which moves weather systems across the Earth, wobbles and weakens. That means the cold air trapped at the top of the planet, called the polar vortex, escapes its normal confines and drifts elsewhere, bringing the short plunges of frigid air that temporarily counteract overall warming trends in places. That happened briefly in January, when winter just made a cameo appearance in the lower 48, Cohen said, but most of the time this year, when the polar vortex went wandering, it hit Europe or Asia with bursts of icy air, not the U.S., so there wasn't an offsetting effect on winter American temperatures. Boston never even got a sniff of single-digit temperatures this year, with a winter low of 14 degrees, and snow? Forget about it, at least in the east and north. In Fort Kent, in far northern Maine, lack of snow canceled an annual dog sled race. The town had 46.8 inches of snow this year as of last week, a bit more than half as much as usual. The rest of the article also describes consequences of the warmer winter, which can lead to longer and more abundant pest seasons. Allergy seasons can worsen. It can mess up the timing of pollinators and birds, and then create consequences for them in terms of finding their food. That does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, March 9th. I've been your reader, Mary Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And as always, we thank you for listening.